Chapter 15. The End of the Beginning. Banerjee returned to Singapore full of indignation against the other members of the medical mission, who, instead of distributing the medicines and drugs free to the sick and suffering, had sold practically the entire valuable stock to the proprietors of pharmacies, thus making small fortunes for themselves. The intensity of his indignation did him credit, for it was the recoil of a truth-loving nature from an exceptionally despicable kind of dishonesty. But I could also see that the misconduct of the doctors provided him with the opportunity of indulging a strongly marked tendency to censoriousness. This in turn constituted a basis for unconscious egotism. He was one of those people who, being themselves strong enough to resist temptation, are unsparing in their condemnation of weaker souls, not realizing that their harshness is only a less easily recognizable expression of the very evil against which they are inveighing. These conclusions I, of course, did not confide to him, for though he was prepared to correct himself the minute anyone convinced him he was wrong, to convince him was extremely difficult. Buddhism was, of course, often mentioned, and I believe he attended one of my lectures. But though admiring its repudiation of the caste system, he was still too deeply committed to forward block ideology to be able to feel much sympathy for so pacifist a teaching. Like many Bengalis, he felt that, by placing a premium on non-violence, Buddhism had weakened India politically. Discussion, therefore, usually ended with our agreeing to differ. But if he was rock, I was water, and subsequent events showed that my words had not been entirely without effect. Meanwhile, being interested mainly in nationalistic politics, especially in the doings of Subhas Bose, whose fate was then the subject of fierce controversy, he investigated the history of the Indian National Army and the so-called provisional government of Azad Hind, former members of both of which still lurked in Singapore. He also collected literature pertaining to the struggle for independence. Through him I met several associates of Bose. One was a quiet, pleasant young schoolmaster who had been nominated Minister of Education and Culture. Another was a Tamil girl who, at the age of 16, had been a sergeant in the Rani of Jhansi regiment. When we met, she and her sister were not only destitute, but greatly distressed by the unwelcome attentions of a horde of Indian sepoys, who seemed to think unprotected girls lawful prey. Banerjee promised to arrange jobs for them in India, and at the time of his departure asked me to continue supplying them with tinned foodstuffs. The literature he collected consisted mostly of books banned in India, such as the speeches of Subhas Bose, which he gave me to read. Though I could not but sympathise wholeheartedly with the cause of Indian independence, the tin soldier militarism of the plump, bespectacled Bengali leader was not to my taste. But the friendship between Banerjee and myself, being an attraction of opposites, seemed only strengthened by such differences of opinion. When, after spending 2 months in Singapore, he embarked for India, we solemnly contracted to meet in Calcutta as soon after my demobilization as possible. The last months of my army life were in some respects the most exasperating of all. Before the unit had been many weeks in Singapore, it became obvious that its work had really ended on VJ Day. Why, then, were we in Singapore? At first we attributed the transfer to the usual army imbecility. But it soon transpired that we were there to do the work of a certain colonial power, which was finding it by no means easy to re-establish its dominion over territories won back from the Japanese. post-war Asia was in no mood to swallow another dose of white imperialism. Ernie and I, and a few other young, unpromoted operators, felt very strongly that if the war had been fought for freedom, then why, now that it was won, should we be called upon to help suppress the freedom movement in a country which, having been liberated from one oppressor, has no desire to see him replaced by another? Besides, England was yielding to demands for independence within her own empire. Why should she be a party to the brutal suppression of a similar demand in territories not her own? We therefore decided on a policy of unconfessed non-cooperation. In our logbooks, we either wrote nil to report, or when this appeared too obviously suspicious, logged one of the wanted call signs and then allowed it to be blacked out by atmospherics. The officers who scrutinised our logbooks must have realised something was amiss, but having no means of checking the reliability of our work, they kept their misgivings to themselves. Objectionable as the task assigned to the unit was, it was the lone dike that prevented us from being engulfed by the circumfluent waters of regular army inanity, which often enough swirled perilously near. The CSM, who was posted to the unit soon after its arrival in Singapore, quickly had us out of our comfortable quarters in the villas, which were allowed to stand empty and under canvas. The monsoon had just started. Torrential rains beat upon the rotten, leaky tents and came soaking and streaming in at 100 places. For more than a month we lived in the midst of mud and cold and damp. Most of us caught chills, several influenza. That, of course, did not matter. We had been made to realise we were in the army. Conditions in the next camp, where we lived in human habitations set amidst beautiful flowering trees, was much better, but either because the owners demanded that they be derequisitioned, or because the brass hats who occupied suites at the Cathay or the Raffles Hotel decided they were too good for us, we did not enjoy them for long. The third and last camp was situated in a rubber plantation in the middle of the island. Outside the gate was a Chinese village. Though we continued to live in tents, the inconvenience was less keenly felt, partly because the monsoon had ended, and partly because the officers now lived under canvas too. Life was at first almost idyllic. Around us, so thickly planted that one could not see through them to the end of the plantation, rose the straight, slender trunks of the rubber trees, with their grey-green foliage, in the shade of which I sometimes wondered if the tent became too hot and stuffy. When not on duty in the set room, which was temporarily housed in the huge half-cylinder of a Nissen hut, we helped erect the rough frame buildings which eventually became our new mess, canteen, recreation room, and ablutions. Prisoners of war also worked in the camp. These included two slim, self-effacing young Japanese officers. Whenever we gave them cigarettes, they clicked their heels and bowed smartly. Both were extremely fond of Western classical music, and often, when the strains of Bach or Beethoven came floating through the canteen door, they could be seen unobtrusively listening. There was also a party of Koreans, slow-moving and unintelligent, though simple and harmless enough. They were farm labourers who had been forcibly impressed into the Japanese army. Every afternoon, when their duties for the day were done, they unconcernedly soaked one another's sturdy, thick-limbed, orange bodies as they stood naked round the pump. We had not enjoyed the amenities of the new camp for more than a few weeks, when the dike burst and the waters came pouring in. A brigadier who inspected the camp was outraged by its lack of discipline. There were far too many men off duty. There were not enough parades, no fatigues, and the supreme horror, no rifle drill. Tents were out of alignment, guy ropes unwhitened. Fire buckets had not had rings painted on them. Several pieces of litter were discernible. The men were improperly dressed. Operators strolled about the camp instead of proceeding in a smart, soldierly manner. Beds were not made up during the day, nor mosquito nets taken down. And so on and so on. The CO was severely reprimanded and told that discipline must be tightened up at once. These instructions were as balm to the soul of the CSM. Though we were spared any rifle drill, there were now daily parades, regular and more strict tent inspections, and frequent fatigues. What did it matter that they were all quite unnecessary? We were in the army. But most of us had been in it long enough to know that, provided one did not refuse to obey an order, it was possible to get away with almost anything. Some reported sick. Others wrote home to their MP complaining about conditions in the unit. Satirical poems appeared on the notice board. In the end, despite a number of petty annoyances, there was no observable improvement in the discipline of the camp. In fact, by giving genuine cause for grievance, discipline had in reality been undermined. That we could not be immediately repatriated and demobilized was obvious to the least intelligent. We were prepared to be patient and wait our turn, but we were not prepared to be harassed by artificially created work and meaningless restrictions simply in order to gratify some pettifogging brass hat's desire to throw his weight around. We refused to be victims to the Moloch of discipline. Some of us went so far as to make it quite obvious by our behaviour that now the war was over, we regarded ourselves as being in the army only in a very nominal sense. I was one of these. Not a minute more than necessary did I spend in the camp. The CSM always looked at me sourly as I went out of the gate. Once he checked me for wearing a white shirt, but it was regulation khaki issue that had faded in the wash. I wore this shirt when, in anticipation of the unit's disbandment, a group photograph was taken. "Who is that man in the white shirt?" roared the CO at the CSM after this souvenir had been developed and printed. On Vaishakha Purnima Day, I went to the CO and said that I was a Buddhist and wanted the day off. "The day off, eh?" said Pringy, as we called him, twirling his moustaches. "Well, we can't lay on a Liberty truck just for one man, can we, Sergeant Major? You'd better give your fatigue party the day off and let them go into town too." The CSM glowered. My original intention had been to be demobilized in England, spend some time with my parents and my sister, and then return to India. But a letter from a friend who had once accompanied me on a visit to Bhikkhu Soma, and who had gone home with a similar intention, caused me to change my mind. Escape from England was impossible, he wrote, as it was the government's policy to discourage any drainage of manpower away from the country. I therefore decided to abandon my hopes of seeing the family and take the law into my own hands. I would apply for 6 weeks' leave in India, once again making Uncle Dick my excuse, and then, when the period was up, instead of returning to Singapore, I would simply disappear. Technically, of course, I would be deserting, but about this I had no qualms. In fact, if not in law, the war was over. Whatever duty I had to my country, I had done, and my life was now my own, to do with as I wished. Had it not been for the relief afforded by my activities in Singapore, the period of suspense which followed this decision would have been intolerable. More than once, in sheer desperation, I was on the point of taking to the jungle and working my way up to Thailand on foot. The nearer the day of liberation drew, the more violent became my desire to escape from the pettiness and futility of army life. But at last, one morning, as in a dream, I found myself in the QM's store, handing in my rifle, my webbing, and the rest of the much-hated equipment that had never been of the slightest use. Though nobody else then knew it, I was never to see that equipment again. Since the day that Ernie and I had trudged up the Leatherhead Lane, there had been no sweeter moments.